purpose, the better to rule. But you must do your duty. Breed! Fill the world with our Titan race. Bring them up to obey me in all things, and I will grant you lands and provinces of your own. Now, bow before me." The Titans bowed low, and Kronos gave a grunt of satisfaction that was the closest he ever came to an expression of happiness. The vengeful prophecy of his father had been averted. The eternal age of the Titans could begin. The Cretan Boy. Kronos may have grunted with satisfaction, but Moros, the figuration of destiny and doom, smiled, as he always does when the powerful exhibit confidence. On this occasion, Moros smiled because he could see that Zeus was flourishing on Crete. He was growing into the strongest and most striking male in all creation. Indeed, his radiance had become almost painful to look upon, as is often the case with extraordinarily attractive people. It is incumbent upon us to apologize or look away when our beauty causes discomfort. The goodness of goat's milk and the nurturing potency of manna had given him strong bones, a clear complexion, sparkling eyes, and glossy hair. He made the journey, to use the Greek terms, from Pais, boy, and Ephebos, teenager, to Kuros, youth, and thence into a fine example of what we might call today a young adult. Even now, the first downy outlines of what was to become a legendary and mighty example of the art of the beard were showing themselves on his chin and cheeks. The question of how long it took for immortals to be weaned, to walk, talk, and grow into adulthood is a vexed one. Some sources maintain that Zeus grew from a baby into young manhood in a single year. Divine time and mortal time seem to have run differently, just like those of dogs and humans do, or elephants and flies, for example. It is probably best for us not to concentrate in too literal a fashion on the temporal structure of myth. Zeus possessed the confidence, the unforced air of command that marks out those destined to lead. He was quicker to laughter than anger, but when his ire was roused, he could frighten every living creature within his orbit. From the first, he exhibited a blend of zest for life and strength of will that filled even his mother with awe, and some attested that Amalthea's milk conferred extraordinary capabilities on the youth as he grew. To this day, Cretan guides entertain visitors with tales of the young Zeus's remarkable powers. They tell the story, as if it happened within their lifetimes, of how, as an infant, playing with his beloved nanny goat and unaware of his own strength, Zeus accidentally snapped off one of her horns. Zeus was always playful. The Romans called him Jupiter, or Jove, so he had quite literally a jovial disposition. The bringer of jollity, Gustav Holst calls him in his orchestral suite, The Planets. But by virtue of his already prodigious divine powers, this broken horn instantly filled itself with the most delicious food. Fresh bread, vegetables, fruit, cured meats, and smoked fish, a supply that never gave out, no matter how much was taken from it. Thus originated the celebrated Horn of Plenty, the cornucopia. Zeus's determined mother visited Crete whenever she felt able to slip away from the ever-watchful Kronos. "Never forget what your father did. He ate your brothers and sisters. He tried to eat you. He is your enemy." Zeus would listen as Rhea described the unhappy condition of the world under Kronos. "He rules by fear. He has no sense of loyalty or trust. This is not the way, my Zeus." "Doesn't that make him strong?" "No, it makes him weak. The Titans are his family, his brothers and sisters, nephews and nieces. Already some are beginning to resent his monstrous tyranny. When your time comes, you will exploit that resentment.
Yes, Mother.
A true leader forges alliances. A true leader is admired and trusted.
Yes, Mother.
A true leader is loved.
Yes, Mother.
Oh, you laugh at me, but it is true.
Yes, Ma...
Rhea slapped her son. Be serious. You are no fool. I can see that for myself. Adamantia tells me that you are intelligent but impetuous, that you spend too much time hunting wolves, teasing the sheep, climbing trees, seducing the ash tree nymphs. It is time you were properly schooled. You are 16 now, and soon we must make our move.
Yes, Mother.
The Oceanid and the Potion. Rhea asked her friend Metis, wise and beautiful daughter of Tethys and Oceanus, to prepare her son for what was to come. He is clever, but wayward and rash. Teach him patience, craft, and guile.
Zeus was captivated by Metis from the start. He had never seen such beauty. The Titaness was a little smaller than most of her race, but endowed with a grace and gravity that made her shine. The step of a deer and the guile of a fox, the power of a lion, the softness of a dove, all allied to a presence and force of mind that sent the boy dizzy.
Lie down with me.
No, we shall go for a walk. I have many things to say to you.
Here, on the grass.
Metis smiled and took his hand.
We have work to do, Zeus.
But I love you.
Then you will do as I say. When we love someone, we always want to please them, do we not?
Don't you love me?
Metis laughed, though in truth she was astounded by the halo of glamour and charisma that radiated from this bold and handsome youth. But her friend Rhea had asked her to undertake his education, and Metis was never one to betray a trust. For a year, she taught him how to look into the hearts and judge the intentions of others, how to imagine and how to reason, how to find the strength to let passions cool before acting, how to make a plan, and how to know when a plan needed to be changed or abandoned, how to let the head rule the heart, and the heart win the affection of others. Her refusal to allow their relationship to take on a physical dimension only made Zeus love her more. Although she never told him so, Metis returned the love. As a result, there existed a kind of crackle in the air whenever the two were close. One day, Zeus saw Metis standing over a large boulder and bashing its flat surface with a small, round-ended stone.
What on earth are you doing?
Crushing mustard seeds and crystals of salt.
Of course you are.
Today, said Metis, is your 17th birthday. You are ready to go to Othrys and fulfill your destiny. Rhea will be here soon, but first I must finish a little preparation of my own devising.
What's in that jar?
In here, there is a mixture of poppy juice and ipecacuanha, sweetened with a syrup of manna provided by the Meliae, our friends of the ash tree. I'll put all the ingredients together and shake them up, like so.
I don't understand.
Look, here is your mother. She will explain. As Metis looked on, Rhea outlined the plan to Zeus. Mother and son gazed deep into each other's eyes, took a deep breath, and swore an oath, son to mother, mother to son. They were ready. Rebirth of the Five. Midnight. The thick cloth
that Erebus and Nyx threw across earth, sea, and sky to mark the end of Hemera's and Aether's diurnal round, blacked the world. In a valley, high up on Mount Othrys, the Lord of All paced alone, banging his chest, restless and miserable. Kronos had grown into the most foul-tempered and discontented titan of all. Power over everything gave him no satisfaction. Since Rhea had, without explanation, banned him from the conjugal bed, sleep had been a stranger to him too. Denied its healing balm, his mood and digestion, neither good at the best of times, had worsened. The last of the babies he had swallowed seemed to have provoked a sharp acid reflux that the previous five had not. Where was the joy in omnipotence when his stomach griped and his thoughts stumbled blindly in the thick fog of insomnia? His heart lifted to a state approaching something like happiness, however, when he heard, unexpectedly, the sound of Rhea's low, sweet voice humming gently to herself as she came up the slope towards the mountain top. Loveliest sister and dearest wife. It was quite natural that she had been a little upset by his consumption of their six children, but she surely understood that he had had no choice. She was a titan. She knew about duty and destiny. He called out to her.
Rhea?
Kronos, awake at this hour?
I have been awake for more days and nights than I can count. Hypnos and Morpheus have made themselves strangers to me. Full of scorpions is my mind, dear wife.
Macbeth, another murderer deprived of sleep and plagued by dark prophecies, was to say the same thing, but not for many years yet.
Oh, tush, my love, cannot the wit and craft of a titaness surpass those silly sleep demons? There is nothing Hypnos and Morpheus can do to soothe your aching body, to calm your racing mind, to ease your wounded spirit that I cannot match with something sweet and warm of my own.
Your sweet, warm lips, your sweet, warm thighs, your sweet, warm...
Those in time, impatient lord. But first, I've brought you a present, a lovely boy to be your cupbearer.
From the recess stepped Zeus, a radiant smile lighting up his handsome face. He bowed and proffered Kronos a jeweled goblet, which the titan snatched greedily.
"Pretty, very pretty. I might try him later," he said, casting an admiring eye over Zeus and drinking down the contents of the goblet in one greedy draught. "But, Rhea, it is you that I love."
It was too dark for him to see that Rhea had hoisted one eyebrow into an arch of contemptuous incredulity.
"You love me?" she hissed. "You love me? You, who ate all but one of my darling children, you dare talk to me of love?"
Kronos gave an unhappy hiccup. He was undergoing the strangest sensations. He frowned and tried to focus. What was Rhea saying? It could not be that she no longer loved him. His mind was even more foggy and his stomach even more turbulent than usual. What was wrong with him? Oh, and there was something else she had said, something that made no sense at all.
What do you mean? He asked in a voice thick with confusion and nausea. By saying that I ate... all but one of your children. I ate all of them, I distinctly remember.
A strong, young voice cracked through the night air like a whip.
Not quite all, father.
Kronos, the nausea rising in an alarming surge, turned in shock to see the young cupbearer step from the shadows.
Who?
Kronos's question turned into a sudden uprush of uncontrollable vomiting. From his gut, in one heaving spasm, erupted a large stone. The linen in which it was once wrapped had long since been dissolved by stomach acid. Kronos gazed at it stupidly, his eyes swimming and his face white. But before he could understand what he was seeing, he was assailed by that horrible and unmistakable feeling that tells a vomiter that there is more to come, far more. Zeus leapt fleetly forward, picked up the regurgitated boulder and hurled it far, far away, much as Kronos had once flung Uranus's genitals far, far away from the exact same spot. The great magnetite stone landed on the mainland at Pytho, later to be named Delphi. It lodged fast in the earth and became the omphalos, or navel stone of Greece, the Hellenic belly button, an enduring symbol of the country's birth, its spiritual centre and magnetic hub. At the command of Gaia, to guard the stone, from out of the ground came a great serpent, Python, an anagram and half-brother of Typhon. We shall have more to do with him in a little while. Inside Kronos, the compound of salt, mustard and ipecacuanha continued to do its emetic work. The potion was prepared by Metis, and it would be nice to think that that is where our word emetic comes from, but I don't think it does. One by one, he spewed up the five children he had swallowed. First out was Hera. Then came Poseidon, Demeter, Hades, and finally Hestia, before the tormented Titan collapsed in a paroxysm of exhausted panting. Although in birth order Hera had been the last to be born before Zeus, she now counted as the second child. A kind of reverse seniority operated as they emerged from Kronos's gullet. Zeus became officially the eldest of the children, while Hestia, having been the firstborn, was now considered the youngest. It makes sense if you are a god. If you recall, Metis's potion included a quantity of poppy juice. This immediately began to take somniferous effect. Letting out one last great rumbling groan, Kronos rolled over and fell into a deep, deep sleep. With a cry of exultation, Zeus bent over his snoring father to grasp the great sickle and administer the coup de grace. He would sever Kronos's head in one blow and raise it up in triumph before the world, creating a victorious tableau that would never be forgotten and that artists would depict until the end of time. But the scythe, forged by Gaia for Kronos, could not be used against him. Powerful as Zeus was, he was unable even to pick it up. He tried once, but it felt as if it was fixed to the ground. "Gaia gave it to him, and only Gaia can take it away from him," said Rhea. "Let it be." "But I must kill him," said Zeus. "We must be revenged. His mother Earth protects him. Do not anger her. You will need her in the time to come. You will have your revenge." Zeus gave up his attempts to move the scythe. It was vexing that he could not behead his hated father as he lay there snoring like a pig. But his mother was right. It could wait. There was too much to celebrate. In the starlight over Mount Othrys, he and his five liberated siblings laughed and stamped and hooted and howled with delight.
Their mother laughed too, clapping her hands with joy to see her radiant sons and daughters so well and so happy, out in the world at last and ready to claim their inheritance. Each of the five rescued ones took it in turn to embrace Zeus, their youngest but now eldest brother, their saviour and their leader. They swore allegiance to him forever. Together, they would overthrow Kronos and his whole ugly race and establish a new order. They would not, despite their parentage, call themselves Titans. They would be gods. And not just gods, but the gods.
2. Clash of the Titans. At the summit of Mount Othrys, Kronos lay stretched out on the ground. The other Titans had not yet learned of Zeus's rescue of his brothers and sisters, but it seemed likely that when they did, they would react with furious violence. Under cover of the night, Rhea and her six children slipped away, putting as great a distance between themselves and Titan country as they could. War, Zeus understood clearly, was inevitable. Kronos would not rest as long as his children lived, and Zeus was just as determined to dethrone his father. He heard louder than ever the sound he had heard within him since infancy, a softly insistent whisper from Moros, telling him that it was his destiny to rule. The bloody, violent, and destructive conflict that followed is known to historians as the Titanomachy. Hesiod offers us the fullest extant account. Later poets sang of it, and an epic called the Titanomachia by Eumelus of Corinth, or possibly the blind Thamyris of Thrace, is tantalizingly mentioned in other texts, but remains lost to us. Hesiod describes the pitched battle that shook the earth like this. The boundless sea rang terribly around, and the earth crashed loudly. Wide heaven was shaken and groaned, and reeled from its foundation under the charge of the undying gods, and a heavy quaking reached dim Tartarus, and the deep sound of their feet in the fearful onset and of their hard missiles. So then they launched their grievous shafts upon one another, and the cry of both armies as they shouted reached to starry heaven, and they met together with a great battle cry. While most of the details of this 10-year war may be lost to us, we do know that the heat and fury, the explosive power and colossal energy released by the battling Titans, gods, and monsters caused mountains to bellow fire and the ground itself to quake and crack. Many islands and land masses were formed by these battles. Whole continents shifted and reshaped themselves, and much of the world as we know it now owes its geography to these seismic disturbances, to this literally earth-shaking conflict. In a straight fight, it is almost certain that the combined strength of the Titans would have been too much for their young adversaries. They were stronger and more remorselessly savage. All but Clymene's sons Prometheus and Epimetheus sided with Kronos, far outnumbering the small group of self-styled gods ranged against them under Zeus's generalship. But just as Uranus had paid dearly for his crime of imprisoning the Cyclopes and Hecatoncheires inside Gaia, so Kronos was about to pay for the blunder of imprisoning them in the caverns of Tartarus. It was the wise and clever Metis who advised Zeus to go down and release his 3 one-eyed and 300-headed brothers. He offered them freedom in perpetuity if they would help him defeat Kronos and the Titans. They needed no further encouragement.
The Gigantes, too, chose to side with Zeus and proved themselves brave and tireless fighters. In the final decisive battle, the pitiless ferocity of the Hecatoncheires, not to mention their surplus of heads and hands, combined quite marvellously with the wild electric power of the Cyclopes, whose names were, if you recall, Brightness, Lightning and Thunder, Arges, Steropes and Brontes. These gifted craftsmen hammered their mastery of storms into thunderbolts for Zeus to use as weapons, which he learned to fling with pinpoint accuracy at his enemies, blasting them to atoms. Under his direction, the Hecatoncheires picked up and hurled rocks at furious speed, while the Cyclopes harried and dazzled the enemy with lightning shows and terrifying peals of thunder. The hundred hands of the Hecatoncheires scooped and launched innumerable rocks at the enemy like so many demented windmilling catapults, until, bludgeoned and battered, the Titans called for a ceasefire. We will leave them, their great bloodied heads bowed in full and final surrender, and take a moment to look at what else had been going on in the world while battle raged for those 10 terrible years. The proliferation. The fire and fury of war had scorched, enriched, and fertilized the earth. New growth burst through to create a fresh green world for the triumphant gods to inherit. If you remember, cosmos had once been nothing but chaos. Then chaos had spewed up the first forms of life, the primordial beings and the principles of lightness and darkness. As each generation developed and new entities were born and in turn reproduced, so complexity increased. Those old primordial and elemental principles were spun into life forms of ever greater diversity, variety, and richness. The beings that were born became endowed with nuanced and unique personalities and individuality. In computer language, it was as if life went from 2-bit to 4-bit to 8-bit to 16-bit to 32-bit to 64-bit and beyond. Each iteration represented millions and then billions of new permutations of size, form, and what you might call resolution, high-definition character, such as we pride ourselves in having as modern humans, came into existence, and there was an explosion of what biologists call speciation as new forms burst into being. I like to picture the first stage of creation as an old-fashioned TV screen on which a monochrome game of Pong played. You remember Pong? It had two white rectangles for rackets and a square dot for a ball. Existence was a primitive, pixelated form of bouncing tennis. Some 35 to 40 years later, there had evolved ultra-high-res 3D graphics with virtual and augmented reality. So it was for the Greek cosmos, a creation that began with clunky and elemental low-res outlines, now exploded into rich, varied life. Creatures and gods that were ambiguous, inconsistent, unpredictable, intriguing, and unknowable had arrived. To use a distinction made by E.M. Forster when talking about people in novels, the world now went from flat characters to rounded characters, to the development of personalities whose actions could surprise. The fun began. The Muses. One of the original Titans, Mnemosyne, Memory, was mother, by Zeus, to 9 highly intelligent and creative daughters, the Muses, who lived at various times on Mount Helicon, where the Hippocrene Fountain later played, on Mount Parnassus above Delphi, and in Pieria in Thessaly, where the Pierian Spring, the metaphorical source of all the arts and sciences, flowed. The Pierides came from Pieria too. They were nine sisters who made the mistake of challenging the Muses, only to be turned into birds for their troubles. Alexander Pope references Pieria as the fount of all wisdom and knowledge in this well-known couplet from his Essay on Criticism. A little learning is a dangerous thing. Drink deep, or taste not the Pierian spring. We think of the Muses today as patron saints of the arts in general and private sources of inspiration in particular. "Oh, for a muse of fire," cries the chorus at the opening of Henry V. "He or she is my muse," we might say, of those who fire our creativity and spur us on to greatness. The Muses can be found in music, amusements, museums, and general musings. W. H. Auden believed that the image of a capricious goddess whispering ideas in the poet's ear was the best way of accounting for the maddening unreliability of creative inspiration. Sometimes she gives you gold, sometimes you read back what she has dictated and see that it is dross. The Muses' mother might be memory, but their father is Zeus, whose faithless inconstancy is the subject of many stories yet to come. But let us meet these nine sisters, each of whom represents and stands patron to their own particular art form. Calliope. Rather an undignified linguistic end meets Calliope, the muse of epic poetry. Somehow she became a steam-powered organ commonly played in fairgrounds, which are just about the only places where you will hear her name spoken today. To Ovid, she was the chief of all the Muses. Her name means beautiful voice, and she gave birth to Orpheus, the most important musician in all Greek history. The finest poets, Homer, Virgil, and Dante included, invoked her aid when embarking on their great epics. Clio. Now relegated to a model of Renault motor car and a series of awards in the advertising industry, Clio, or Cleo, famous, was the muse of history. She was responsible for proclaiming, for noising abroad, and making famous the deeds of the great. America's oldest debating union, founded in Princeton by James Madison, Aaron Burr, and others, is called the Cleosophical Society, in her honour. Euterpe. Muse of music itself, the delightful and joyous Euterpe, bore, by the river god Strymon, the Thracian king Rhesus, who went on to play a very minor part in the Trojan War. Whether he gave his name to the monkeys that in turn went on to describe types of human blood factor is not agreed upon. Erato. Erato was the muse of lyric and love poetry. Her name is related to Eros and the erotic, and she has sometimes been represented in art with a golden arrow to suggest the connection. Turtle doves and the myrtle are common symbols associated with her, as is the lute. Melpomene. The tragic muse, Melpomene, whose name derives from a Greek verb meaning to celebrate with dance and song, represented originally the chorus and then the whole of tragedy, a very important fusing of music, poetry, drama, masque, dance, song, and religious celebration. Tragic actors wore a type of thick-soled boot to give the actors added height and with it metaphorical stature too, called a buskin in English and the cothurnus in Greek, and Melpomene is usually depicted either holding or wearing these, as well as, of course, the famous tragic mask, with its unhappy down-curved lips. Along with her sister Terpsichore, she was a mother to the sirens. Polyhymnia. Hymnos is the Greek for praise, and Polyhymnia was the muse of hymns, of sacred music, dance, poetry, and rhetoric, as well as, slightly randomly, one might think, agriculture, pantomime, geometry, and meditation. I suppose today we would call her the muse of mindfulness. She is usually portrayed as a rather serious figure, finger held pensively to her mouth, caught in an attitude of solemn rumination. She is another contender, along with Calliope, for mother of the heroes Orpheus and Linus. Terpsichore. Cheese shop owner. Oh, I thought you were complaining about the bouzouki player. Customer. Oh, heaven forbid. I am one who delights in all manifestations of the Terpsichorean muse. This dialogue from Monty Python's immortal cheese shop sketch introduced many, myself included, to Terpsichore, the muse of the dance. Thalia. The finest, funniest, friendliest muse of all, Thalia supervised the comic arts and idyllic poetry. Her name derives from the Greek verb for to flourish, which also gave us, via the word for a flourishing green shoot, the element thallium, a favourite of crime writers and criminal poisoners. Like her tragic counterpart Melpomene, she sports actor's boots and a mask, hers being the cheerful, smiling one, of course, but she is wreathed in ivy and carries a bugle and a trumpet. Urania. Urania derives her name from Uranus, the primal god of the heavens and a great-grandfather of the Nine Sisters. She is the muse who presides over astronomy and the stars. She is also considered a figure of universal love, a kind of Greek version of the Paraclete or Holy Spirit. Threesomes. The 3x3 muses remind me to introduce more triads. Gaia and Uranus gave birth, as we know, to 3 Hecatoncheires, 3 Cyclopes, and 4x3 Titans. We have already encountered the 3 Erinyes, also called the Eumenides, those vengeful furies who sprang from the blood-soaked earth at the moment of the castration of Uranus. 3 seems to have been a very magic number to the Greeks. The Charites. During the course of the 10-year Titanomachy, apocalyptic as it was, Zeus always found time to fulfill his desires. Perhaps he saw it as discharging his duty to populate the earth. It is certainly the case that Zeus liked to discharge. One day, Zeus's eye fell on the most beautiful of all the Oceanids, Eurynome, daughter of Oceanus and Tethys. Hidden in a cave, while the battle roared outside, Eurynome bore Zeus 3 ravishing daughters, Aglaia, which means splendour, Euphrosyne, also known as Euthymia, glee, merriment, mirth, and Thalia, cheerfulness, sharing her name with the muse of comedy. Together they were known as the Charites, or to the Romans the Gratii. We call them the 3 Graces, favoured throughout history by sculptors and painters seeking an excuse to render perfect female nudes. Their sweetness of nature gave the world something to counteract the horrible malice and cruelty of the Erinyes. Horae. The Horae, or Hours, consisted of 2 sets of triplet sisters. These daughters of Themis, the embodiment of law, justice, and custom, originally personified the seasons. There seem to have been 2 to begin with, summer and winter. Auxesia, sometimes just Auxo, and Carpo. The classical first triad of Horae was made up by the later addition of Thallo, Flora to the Romans, bringer of flowers and blossoms, the embodiment of spring. The Horae's most valuable quality derived from their mother, their gift of the propitious moment, the benign relationship between natural law and the unfolding of time, what you might call divine serendipity. The second set of Horai was responsible for a more worldly kind of law and order. They were Eunomia, goddess of law and legislation, Dike, goddess of justice and the moral order, the Roman equivalent is Justitia, and Irene, the goddess of peace, pax to the Romans. Moirai. The Moirai, or three fates, were named Clotho, Lachesis, and Atropos. These daughters of Nyx are to be thought of as sitting round a spinning wheel. Clotho spins the thread that represents a life. Lachesis measures out its length, and Atropos, the relentless, remorseless one, literally the unturning, chooses when to shear the thread and cut the life short. Atropine, the poison derived from mandrakes and Atropa belladonna, deadly nightshade, gets its name from this last and most terrible of the sisters. Even the gods had to submit themselves to the fate's cruel decrees. Later Greeks considered them to be not daughters of the night, but of necessity, Ananke. They bear a very strong resemblance to the Norns of Norse mythology. I picture them as sunken-cheeked crones, clothed in black rags, sitting in a cave, cackling and nodding as they spin. But many sculptors and poets represented them as pink-cheeked maidens, dressed in white robes and smiling demurely. Their name derives from a word that means portion or lot, in the sense of that which is allotted to you. It was not her portion to be loved, or it was his lot to be unhappy, are the kinds of phrases Greeks employed to describe attributes or destinies apportioned by the Moirai. Kyries. These carrion daughters of Nyx were the vile and rapacious spirits of violent death. Like the Valkyries of Norse and Germanic myth, they collected the souls of warriors killed in battle. Unlike those benevolent warrior goddesses, however, the Kyries did not escort their heroic souls to the reward of a Valhalla. They flew from bleeding body to body, greedily sucking up the blood that flowed from them. Then, when each corpse was thoroughly drained, they threw it over their shoulders and moved on to the next. Gorgons. The primordial sea god Pontus had, by Gaia, a son, Phorcys, and a daughter, Ceto. The progeny of this brother and sister were three island-dwelling sisters, the Gorgons, Stheno, Euryale, and Medusa. With hair of writhing, venomous snakes, intense, staring eyes, hideous, fixed smiles, boar's tusk teeth, clawed hands of brass and taloned feet, and scaly, golden bodies, these monstrous sisters appeared frightful enough to freeze the blood. But anyone who caught a Gorgon's eye, exchanged looks with her for just one fleeting second, would, quite literally, be turned instantly to stone. The word for that is petrified, which has come to mean scared stiff. Spirits of air, earth, and water. These threesomes were not the only significant beings to spring into life at this time. All over the world, as the Titanomachy raged around them, nature sprites and spirits of all kinds began to multiply and claim their areas of sovereignty. One pictures them scampering for shelter and trembling behind bushes while the rocks and thunderbolts fly through the air and the earth shakes with the violence of war. Somehow, these often fragile beings survived and thrived to enrich the world with their beauty, dedication, and charm. Perhaps the best known of them are the nymphs, a major class of minor female deities, divided into clans or subspecies according to their habitats. The Oreads held court in the mountains, hills, and grottos of Greece and its islands, while the Nereids, like the Oceanids from whom they descended, were denizens of the deep. Naiads, their freshwater counterparts, were found in lakes and streams of running water, or in the reeds that fringed them and on riverbanks. Over time, some water nymphs began to associate themselves with ever more specific realms. Soon there were the Pegae, who looked after natural springs, and Potameiades, who dwelt in and around rivers. The Tagides were nymphs associated with just one river, the Tagus, but now that I've mentioned them, we can forget all about them as we shan't meet them ever again. On land, the Auloniades kept to pastures and groves, while the Lymacides lived in meadows. Woodland spirits included light-winged dryads and the hamadryads, sylvan nymphs whose lives were tied to the trees they made their home. When their tree died or was cut down, they died too. More specialist wood nymphs populated just apple trees or laurels. The Meliae, nymphs of the sweet manna-bearing ash tree, we have already met. The fate of the hamadryads shows that nymphs could die. They never aged or fell prey to diseases, but they were not always immortal. And so, while the natural world ripened, rippled, and replicated in this prodigiously bravura manner, seeding itself with ever more marvellous demigods and immortals, the earth trembled and shook with the violence and terror of war. But this proliferation ensured, when the smoke and dust of battle at last cleared, the victors would rule a world filled with life, colour, and character. The triumphant Zeus was set to inherit an earth, sea, and sky infinitely richer than the one into which he had been born. Dispenser supreme and judge of the earth. Zeus now moved to make sure the defeated Titans could never rise again to threaten his order. His strongest and most violent opponent in the war had not been Cronos, but Atlas, the brutally powerful eldest son of Iapetus and Clymene. Atlas's brother, Menoetius, whose name means doomed might, had been a furiously powerful and terrible opponent too, but Zeus had destroyed him with one of the very first thunderbolts. Atlas had been at the center of every battle, rousing his fellow Titans into combat, shouting for one last supreme effort, even as the Hecatoncheires were battering them into submission. As punishment for his enmity, Zeus sentenced him to hold up the sky for eternity. This killed two birds with one stone. Zeus's predecessors, Cronos and Uranus, had been forced to waste much of their energy in separating heaven from earth. At a stroke, Zeus relieved himself of that draining burden and placed it, quite literally, on the shoulders of his most dangerous enemy. At the junction of what we would call Africa and Europe, the Titan strained, the whole weight of the sky bearing down upon him. Legs braced, muscles bunched, his mighty body contorted itself with this supreme and agonizing effort. For aeons he groaned there like a Bulgarian weightlifter. In time, he solidified into the Atlas Mountains that shoulder the skies of North Africa to this day. His straining, squatting image is to be found on copies of the very first maps of the world, which in his honour we still call atlases. These later images show him holding up not the sky, but the world.
To one side of him lies the Mediterranean, and to the other, the ocean still named after him, the Atlantic, where the mysterious island kingdom of Atlantis is said to have flourished. As for Kronos, the dark, unhappy soul who had once been lord of all, the brooding and unnatural tyrant who ate his own children out of fear of prophecy, his punishment, just as his gelded father Uranos had foretold, was ceaselessly to travel the world, measuring out eternity in inexorable, perpetual, and lonely exile. Every day and hour and minute was his to be marked out, for Zeus doomed Kronos to count infinity itself. We can see him everywhere, even today, the gaunt, sinister figure with his sickle, now given the cheap and humiliating nickname Old Father Time. His sallow, drawn features tell us of the inevitable and merciless ticking of cosmos's clock, driving all to their end days. The scythe swings and cuts like a remorseless pendulum. All mortal flesh is as grass beneath the cruel sweep of its mowing blade. We find Kronos in all things chronic or synchronized, in chronometers, chronographs, and chronicles. To some mythographers, Kronos the Titan and Kronos Time are quite separate entities. I prefer the versions that unite them. The Romans gave this saturnine, sallow husk of a defeated Titan the name Saturn. He hangs in the sky between his father Uranus and his son Jupiter. The numerous moons of Saturn include Titan, Iapetus, Atlas, Prometheus, Hyperion, Tethys, Rhea, and Calypso. Then there are the rings of Saturn. Perhaps they signify time, like the rings of a tree. Not all the Titans were banished or punished. To many, Zeus showed magnanimity and mercy. Some of the Titanides were very attractive, and as lustful, highly sexed, and prone to falling in love as any being that has ever lived, Zeus already had designs on one or two of the more appealing ones. However, on those few who had sided with him in the war, he showered favours. Atlas's brother Prometheus was chief amongst those who had had the prescience, and prescience or forethought is just what the name Prometheus means, to fight for the gods against their own kind. Zeus rewarded him with his companionship, taking ever more delight in the young Titan's presence, until one day, which was to have massive consequences for humankind, consequences we feel even now. The story of that friendship and its tragic end will be told soon. During the war, the Cyclopes had, as mentioned, given Zeus in respectful homage the weapon with which he is always associated, the thunderbolt. Their brothers, the Hecatoncheires, whose tremendous strength had secured victory, were rewarded by being sent back to Tartarus, not as prisoners this time, but as guardians of the gates to those imponderable depths. The Third Order. The shattered world was still smoking from the savagery of war. Zeus saw that it needed to heal, and he knew that his own generation, the third order of divine beings, must manage better than the first two had done. It was time for a new order, an order purged of the wasteful bloodlust and elemental brutality that had marked earlier times. To the victors, the spoils. Like a chief executive who has just completed a hostile takeover, Zeus wanted the old management out and his people in. He allotted each of his siblings
their own domains, their areas of divine responsibility. The President of the Immortals chose his cabinet. For himself, he assumed overall command as supreme leader and emperor, lord of the firmament, master of weather and storms, king of the gods, sky father, cloud gatherer. Thunder and lightning were his to command. The eagle and the oak were his emblems, symbols then as now of fierce grace and unopposable might. His word was law, his power formidably great. But he was not perfect. He was very, very far from being perfect. Hestia. Of all the gods, Hestia, first to be devoured and the last to be yielded up again, is probably the least well known to us, perhaps because the realm that Zeus in his wisdom apportioned to her was the hearth. In our less communal age of central heating and separate rooms for each family member, we do not lend the hearth quite the importance that our ancestors did, Greek or otherwise. Yet even for us, the word stands for something more than just a fireplace. We speak of hearth and home. Our word, hearth, shares its ancestry with heart, just as the modern Greek for hearth is kardia, which also means heart. In ancient Greek, the wider concept of hearth and home was expressed by the oikos, which lives on for us today in words like economics and ecology. The Latin for hearth is focus, which speaks for itself. It is a strange and wonderful thing that out of words for a fireplace, we have spun cardiologist, deep focus, and eco-warrior. The essential meaning of centrality that connects them also reveals the great significance of the hearth to the Greeks and Romans, and consequently the importance of Hestia, its presiding deity. Refusing offers of marriage from the other gods, Hestia devoted herself to perpetual maidenhood. Placid, contented, kind, hospitable, and domestic, she tended to stay away from the everyday power struggles and political machinations of the other gods. A modest divinity, Hestia is usually depicted in a plain gown, offering up flame in a bowl, or sitting on a coarse woolen cushion on a simple wooden throne. It was the custom in Greece to say a grace to her before every meal. Hospitality, or xenia, was so extraordinarily esteemed in the Greek world that Hestia shared the care of it with Zeus himself, who was, on occasion, given the name Zeus Xenios. Sometimes the gods tested human guest friendship, as we shall see in the story of Philemon and Baucis. This was known as theoxenia. Xenophobes, of course, do not extend the hand of friendship to strangers. The Romans, whose name for Hestia was Vesta, considered her so important that they had a school of priestesses devoted to her, the celebrated Vestal Virgins. Their responsibility, aside from lifelong celibacy, was to make sure that the flame representing her was never extinguished. They were the original guardians of the sacred flame. You can imagine, then, that there are not many great stories about this gentle and endearing goddess. I only know one, which we will hear before long. Naturally, she comes out of it very well. The Lottery. Zeus turned next to his dark and troublesome brothers, Hades and Poseidon. They had acquitted themselves with equal skill, bravery, and cunning in the war against the Titans, and he thought it only fair that they should draw lots for the two most important unassigned provinces, the sea and the underworld. You will recall that Cronos had wrested control of all things in, under, and over the sea from Thalassa, Pontus, Oceanus, and Tethys. Now Cronos was gone, and the saltwater realm was in Zeus's gift.
As for the underworld, which included Tartarus, the mysterious meadows of Asphodel, of which more later, and the subterranean darkness controlled by Erebus, it was time for those also to be subject to one presiding deity, one of Zeus's generation. Hades and Poseidon had no love for each other. And when Zeus put his hands behind his back and brought them out before him in closed fists, they hesitated. In cases of fraternal dislike, each brother will usually want what the other wants. Did Hades hope for the sea or the underworld? Poseidon wondered. If he wants the underworld, then I want that too, just to infuriate him. Hades thought along the same lines. Whichever I choose, he said to himself, I will shout in triumph, just to annoy that prick Poseidon. In each of Zeus's outstretched fists lay concealed a precious stone, a sapphire as blue as the sea in one, and a piece of jet as black as Erebus in the other. Poseidon did a jig of delight when he touched the back of Zeus's right hand and saw it open to reveal the winking blue sapphire. The oceans are mine, he roared. That means yes, cried Hades with a mighty fist pump. That means I have the underworld. Ha ha ha! Secretly, inside, he was sickened. Gods are such children. Hades. This was the last time Hades was ever seen to laugh. From that moment on, any merriment or sense of fun deserted him. Perhaps the duties of king of the underworld slowly ground away any youthful zest or lightness of touch that may once have been his. Down to the depths he went to carve out his kingdom. While his name will always be associated with death and the afterlife and the whole realm of the underworld, which shares his name, with pain, punishment, and perpetual suffering, Hades also came to symbolize riches and opulence. The jewels and precious metals that are mined deep underground and the priceless crops of grain, vegetables and flowers that germinate beneath the earth are all reminders that from decay and death spring life, abundance and wealth. The Romans called him Pluto, and words like plutocrat and plutonium tell of this great opulence and power. You will sometimes see the name Dis, a Latin word for rich, used for him, or his Judeo-Christian descendant, Lucifer. Dante, in his Inferno, called the city of hell Dis. Today, only cryptic crossword setters use the name with any frequency. Under Hades' personal command came Erebus and Nyx, and their son Thanatos, Death himself. A system of river deities, too dark and dreadful to flow in the open air, wound their way through this underworld. The principal was Styx, Hate, a daughter of Tethys and Oceanus, whose name and Stygian attributes are invoked to this day whenever we want to describe something dark, menacing and gloomy, something hellishly black and brooding. Into her flowed Phlegethon, the flaming river of fire, Acheron, the river of woe, Lethe, the waters of forgetfulness, and Cocytus, the stream of lamentation and wailing. Styx's brother Charon was appointed ferryman, and for the time being he waited, leaning on his pole by the banks of the Styx. He had dreamed that one day souls by the thousand would come to the shores of the river and pay him the price of transport across. One day, soon. Space was given by Hades to the Furies, the earth-born Erinyes, to live within the darkest heart of his kingdom. From there,
the three of them could fly to all corners of the world to exact their revenge on those transgressors whose crimes were foul enough to merit their violent attentions. In time, Hades acquired a pet, a gigantic, snake-tailed, three-headed dog, offspring of those monstrous children of Gaia and Tartarus, Echidna and Typhon. His name was Cerberus, although he answered to his Roman name, Cerberus, too. He was the original Hound of Hell, the fearsome and tireless watchdog and guardian of the underworld. At Lerna, a lake that could be used as one of the entrances to the underworld, Hades posted Hydra, another child of Tartarus and Gaia. I mentioned before the frightening mutations possible when monsters mate, and the difference between Cerberus and his sister Hydra offers a striking example. On the one hand, a dog with a more or less manageable three heads and an elegant snaky tail to wag, and on the other, his sister, a many-headed water beast who was almost impossible to kill. Chop off one of her heads, and she could grow back 10 more in its place. Despite these zoological atrocities, Hades was, for the time being, a quiet place, ruled over by a god with little to do. In order for hell to be busy, mortal beings are needed, creatures that die.